Jerry Bays and Jerry Ketter for this opportunity to speak to you during this study. My subject is somewhat off the path, or somewhat off, you might say, the general theme of this particular study, yet I believe it is an important one. First of all, I'd like to point out the need for teaching on this issue. Some might question the need or the worth of devoting time to teach and preach about creation and evolution. Now, while the proverbial posture of the ostrich may provide a temporary freedom from the discomforts of conflict, it is certainly only a temporary solution. Speaking of the refusal to meet error head on and recognizing its danger, G.K. Chesterton said, "If a man proves too clearly and convincingly to himself that a tiger is an optical illusion, he will find out by and by that he is wrong. The tiger will himself intervene in the discussion in a manner which will be in every sense conclusive." I believe that the evolutionary philosophy is a tiger in the streets of modern society, and perhaps even to an extent unknown in the church. The idea that the theory of evolution is not to be feared and is not to be taught against is as illogical as maintaining that false teachers and false teaching must not be taught against. Now, we may have utter confidence in Christ, in the Bible, and in our faith, but we must fear the influence of evolutionary philosophy upon our children, upon those who are weak or unstable in the faith, and also upon those who are out there in the world and potential converts. Who can tell the number of hearts that have been turned into stony soil because they have been deluded by this philosophy in some guise or form or another? We must not forget that Satan, our adversary, has the uncanny ability to dress up error with plausible arguments and make it sound all right. We must also not forget that the evolutionary philosophy of our day and time is a product of a number of highly educated men. These men are no dummies. It is a result of over a century of intense scientific endeavor. And to the uninformed student picking up a textbook heavily laden with evolutionary dogma, evolution may seem to be an impregnable structure. He does not have at hand the knowledge or the experience to criticize or discover its inconsistencies and its fallacies. Well, I believe there are a few real important reasons why we have to deal with this issue. First of all, it gets at the very heart of the most important questions in life. These three questions are, number one, where did I come from? Number two, why am I here? And number three, where am I going? Now, your answer to the first of those questions, where did I come from, is going to affect your answer to the other two questions. And a person is going to be influenced in all of their decisions in this life according to how they answer that first question. If you believe you are a chance concourse of atoms, little more than an exalted animal, there is all likelihood that you will make decisions in life based on that fact, or what you believe to be a fact. You will, perhaps at times, behave like a beast or an animal. If, however, you believe that you are the product of intelligent creation, that a moral God, a moral governor of the universe has made you and brought you into existence, you're going to recognize your responsibility to that moral governor. And you are going to recognize that just as the world had a beginning, so that same God, the creator, shall bring this world to an end, and you will be held accountable for how you lead your life. And so the question of evolution and creation is an important one because it has everything to do with the decisions that one makes in life oftentimes. We also must point out that truth is at stake. There can be no reconciling of evolution and creation. There are people, and I must confess, when I was a teenager and going to high school, I was of this mind. There are people who are double-minded on this issue. At the same time, they try to hold on to their religious beliefs. They are accepting what they hear perhaps in school or from others concerning the origin of this world. These two are ultimately in absolute conflict. The evolutionists realize this. Those who are creationists realize this. I cannot imagine a more contradictory position than that of theistic evolution. And with that, I'll say my say on theistic evolution because I just don't have time to deal with it in depth this morning. Theistic evolution is a contradiction in terms. The two systems are in absolute and total contradiction. Now, I also want to point out that if evolution can explain the origin and development of our world, then there is no need for a personal God at all. W.R. Thompson, a professor writing in the introduction of The Origin of the Species, Charles Darwin's book, says the doctrine of evolution by natural selection, as Darwin formulated it and as his followers still explain it, has a strong anti-religious flavor. For the majority of its readers, Origin effectively dissipated the evidence of providential control. I could give you quote after quote this morning from evolutionists saying that evolution is the proof that men do not need God, that God is an antiquated idea. Abraham Lincoln was born on February the 12th, 1809. On the same day, across the sea in Shrewsbury, England, Charles Darwin was born. Some people have taken this coincidence and tried to make a point out of it. They say that just as Abraham Lincoln freed men from physical slavery, Charles Darwin has freed men from spiritual slavery and religious superstition. Of course, the point just simply illustrates the antipathy of opposition of the evolutionist to religion. That is, the evolutionist who really understands the implications of evolution. And finally, as far as a reason for fighting against evolution, I want to point out that it undermines the Bible. Evolution strikes at the very heart of the Bible. I would like to point out that of some 54 passages from Genesis chapters 1 through 11, there are 87 quotations and allusions in 18 different New Testament books. And so if Genesis is undermined as an accurate and truthful record of past history, then virtually the entirety of the Bible is undermined. There are over 67 clear and distinct allusions to God's creative power in bringing this world to pass in the Bible, from Genesis to the book of Revelation. If you discount the account of Genesis as to our origin, you have undermined the authority of the Bible. Now, we do not reject evolution because it undermines the authority of our book. There are other and many good and credible reasons why we must reject it. But this is certainly one of them. Jesus, too, his teaching is undermined if you reject the teaching of Genesis chapters 1 through 3. In the controversy over divorce and remarriage that the Pharisees brought to Jesus, in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus simply said in Matthew 19 and verse 4, "He which made them in the beginning made them male and female." So he was hearkening them back to a time when God had created the human race, had created the first man and woman, and Jesus spoke of this as a fact of history. Now, as he said to Nicodemus on one occasion, "If I have told you of earthly things and you believe not, how shall I tell you of spiritual things?" If the Bible cannot give us a credible and reliable history of earthly things, then it cannot be trusted in spiritual things. So we must equip ourselves with the basic knowledge to answer those who are confused by the conflict of creation and evolution. The answers are there. That's what I tell young people all the time. People, and especially young people, need to realize there are rational and scriptural answers to the assertions of evolutionary dogma. There are men out there in the world, creation scientists, they call themselves, who are just as concerned about the pernicious effect of evolution, both on science and religion, as we are. And they have done much to combat this error. Parents, preachers, teachers, elders, and all concerned Christians should do something, at least, to equip themselves to combat the error of evolution. Now I'd like to turn my attention for a brief while to, as brief as I could possibly do it, cover something of the history of evolutionary thought. A lot of people have the idea that Charles Darwin is, you might say, the fountainhead of evolutionary philosophy. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the idea of evolution was old when Charles Darwin was born. And in fact, Charles Darwin really said nothing that was significantly new or novel when he presented his theories in his book, The Origin of the Species by Natural Selection. That book appeared in 1859. But 6 centuries before Christ, there were Greek philosophers who were espousing evolutionary ideas. One philosopher named Empedocles, who lived about in the 5th century before Christ, taught that parts of bodies were formed independently, heads without necks, arms without shoulders, eyes without their sockets, and were brought together by random arrangements by a force which he called love. Many of the arrangements of anatomical parts were so abnormal that they were only able to live for a short time. Others were less abnormal and lived for some time. Those individuals who were best fitted to live persisted and are represented among living animals and human beings today. Well, does that sound crazy? I think that all of us would agree yes. Yet Empedocles is embraced by evolutionists as being the father of evolution. Why? Why with such a ridiculous scheme of things as that? I'll tell you why. Because he wrote God out of the picture. Because he said it was pure chance. It was something that happened in nature. He was a naturalist. And because he eliminated God and creation as far as an explanation in his philosophy for the origin of the world, he's called the father of evolution by the evolutionists. There are other Greek philosophers and scientists we could mention, but we must hasten on. It was, for a long time, a new point. In fact, there was not much discussion about it until the beginning of the Renaissance, or what is often called the Age of Enlightenment. In actuality, if you study the history of the Age of Enlightenment, it seems to me that in many respects, men were just digging themselves into deeper and darker holes as far as spiritual perceptivity is concerned. Because much of the Enlightenment simply consisted of men's rationalistic and naturalistic objections to the Bible, to the supernatural, and to the existence of God. Of course, a number of factors conspired to bring about the rise of naturalism and rationalism, especially in the 17th and 18th centuries. Naturalism is simply a philosophy that attempts to explain all phenomena and values through strictly natural means, as opposed to supernatural. Therefore, things like the resurrection, the virgin birth, creation, the Bible, as inspired by deity, is all written off. Rationalism, following hard on the heels of naturalism, took the whole matter one step further. It is defined as any philosophical theory that assigns first place to reason in the attainment of knowledge. The term is most often applied to 18th century philosophers who attacked religion by rejecting all claims based on faith and revelation. Now, I want to point out right here that long before evolution became popular, men were becoming enamored of these two philosophical systems, naturalism and rationalism. But when you adopt this posture, naturally, you have to come up with some other explanation for how the world got here. There were a number of men who contributed their explanations. There were, first of all, what I call the French evolutionists, men like Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, Pierre de Maupertuis, and Georges de Buffon. These three men were anticipating Charles Darwin in many of his cardinal points by a century in some cases. These people taught things like survival of the fittest, natural selection, before Charles Darwin was even born. All of these men were rationalists, they were naturalists, who had a hatred for things pertaining to religion and the Bible. The writer of Forerunners of Darwin says of Pierre de Maupertuis that the reason he proposed evolution through natural selection was that he considered and had desired to refute the argument for the existence of God from the apparent order and design seen in nature. Another fellow named Georges de Buffon, a biologist, expressed his evolutionary ideas in The Natural History of Animals. He, too, did not believe the Bible. Perhaps the most famous of this trio was Chevalier de Lamarck. He was a fellow who taught that giraffes got their necks, their long necks, because ancestors of theirs had stretched for the high leaves on trees, and so had passed on to their successive generations the longer necks. And of course, for a while, Darwin advocated this view too, especially as he could not explain how natural selection came to take place. In the book Forerunners of Darwin, Charles Gillespie quotes the French writer Saint Beuve, who says of Lamarck that his philosophical hostility amounted to hatred for the tradition of the deluge, that's the flood, and the biblical creation story, indeed for everything which recalled Christianity. And so this was the bias or the mindset of these early evolutionists, the French evolutionists. Eventually, there were men in England who took up this as well. One of these men was a man by the name of Erasmus Darwin. He was the grandfather of Charles Darwin. And long before Charles was born, Erasmus's evolutionary ideas were called Darwinism. He believed virtually everything his grandson made famous in Origin of the Species. After Erasmus, came Robert Darwin, who was the father of Charles. Robert and Erasmus were both anti-theistic. They were agnostic as far as belief in God was concerned, and I believe that they impressed upon Charles this attitude at a very early age. Now, Charles Darwin, as we turn our attention to him, is an interesting character. He was born an heir to fortune on both sides of his family. His grandfather Erasmus and his father Robert had been successful physicians and scientists, and they were very wealthy men. On the other side of his family, his mother, who was a very religious woman, was a descendant of Josiah Wedgwood, who was the maker of the Wedgwood china, which we are familiar with even today. So Charles Darwin had money on both sides of his family, and at a very early age, he realized that he was going to be independently wealthy for life. This instilled in him a love for leisure that was absolutely aggravating to his father. And one time, Robert Darwin said, "You care for nothing but shooting dogs and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to you and all your family." I believe this attitude or this relationship between father and son is very important, because I believe that Charles Darwin, especially in his pushing the theory of evolution later in life, was simply trying to live up to the expectations of a father who found no pleasure in his shiftless and worthless son. In those days, when a wealthy father had what he considered a worthless son, the solution was to send him to seminary. So Charles was packed off to Christ College, Cambridge, and there he was expected to prepare for the ministry of all things. Well, a poor choice couldn't have been made. As a youth, he had indulged in pleasurable pursuits, and in the days that he attended Christ College, the school had a reputation for gambling, drunkenness, moral laxity, and lack of discipline. The highest aspirations of the students were to be recognized as authorities of food and drink. One member of the faculty spent most of his time at the horse races, and another high official of the school was said to have never opened his mouth without uttering an oath. Such was the environment Charles Darwin found himself in. And of all places, Christ College, Cambridge, was one of the places that was the place to go if you wanted to be exposed to anti-theistic and evolutionary philosophies in particular. While at Cambridge, Darwin became acquainted with the work of a man named Charles Lyell. Now, Lyell is important to the history of evolution. Lyell is the one who wrote, early in the 1800s, the Principles of Geology. And this book was destined to have a very great effect upon Charles Darwin. In Principles of Geology, Lyell takes a position of uniformitarianism, which is basically the position that all the things that can now be observed as having an effect upon the geological and geographical features of the Earth have always been occurring. Uniformitarianism is opposed to the teaching of God's Word. It is antithetical to catastrophism, which is basically a description for what we call the flood. And the momentous changes that no doubt took place in the Earth's geology during that pre-flood and during the flood time. The motto of uniformitarianism is found in 2 Peter 3, verse 4. All things continue as they were from the beginning. Now turn with me, if you will, to 2 Peter 3. We'll read verses 3 through 7. This is an important passage of Scripture as far as the theory of uniformitarianism is concerned. The Apostle Peter here says, "Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lust, and saying, where is the promise of this coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of the creation. For this they willingly are ignorant of, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, for by the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth which are now, by the same word are kept in store, reserved unto fire against the day of judgment and perdition of ungodly men." Now he's simply forecasting or predicting the day would come when scoffers would deny the flood. Charles Lyell is just such a fellow. In his works, he roundly condemned the record of Moses. He called it the superstitions of Moses. He tried to eliminate in the minds of his students any belief in the Noahic flood. He was certainly opposed to the scriptures. He claimed to be a deist. He claimed to believe there was a supreme intelligence, but even later in life, he was so fully persuaded of the evolutionary philosophy of Charles Darwin that even then, he recanted those earlier beliefs and proclaimed himself to be fully persuaded infidel and, of course, an atheist. Now, there's a lot more I'd like to say about the history of evolution, but I can tell from looking at the clock that I'm running out of time. So I'm going to skip ahead, and I'm going to say this. There are some good works available on the history of evolution, and it is very interesting reading. One of these is by Bert Thompson, a member of the Lord's Church. And this Bert Thompson wrote a book entitled The History of Evolutionary Thought. Very interesting reading. Now I'd like to describe to you the situation as far as evolution is concerned today. A lot of people have the idea that evolution is some kind of monolithic structure. You know, all these scientists and all these institutions of higher learning are united in their views on evolution. Nothing could be further from the truth. As is typically human on any question, there are all kinds of differences in opinions. There is hardly any point of the evolutionary doctrine that is common in our world today that is not being contested somewhere, someplace, between evolutionists. They're not even all in agreement as to what is right and what is wrong in their own theory. Now, the common form of evolution today is called Neo-Darwinian evolution. Now, it's called Neo-Darwinian evolution because at the time that Darwin formulated his ideas about evolution, he had one very important piece of information that wasn't available to him. It was available, it just wasn't recognized. Now, Darwin postulated that the way evolution took place was by natural selection. Perhaps a more fitting term, one that might be more recognizable, is the term survival of the fittest. But he didn't understand, because he just didn't know what could have caused differences between organisms. In other words, what causes the variation in organisms? As we look out around this room, we see every one of us looks different from another, until we can tell each other apart. As we look at the realm of nature, there is variation for a fact. Well, Charles Darwin and early evolutionists simply believed evolution was proved simply by the fact of variation. What they didn't understand was that God built in to all living organisms a means of information transmission called genes and chromosomes. By that way, information, hereditary information, is passed on from generation to generation. And so all life has a gene pool to draw from. And there are variations in the genes and chromosomes that are available to construct life. But now Charles Darwin didn't understand that. He had he made several guesses of what it might be. But later, a man named Hugo de Vries came along and building upon the findings of Gregor Mendel, who was, you might say, the father of genetics, he postulated that the way organisms began to vary so as to provide some organisms that were better suited to live and others that were less well suited to live was through what he called beneficial mutation. In other words, some mutant happened in a gene. Some mutation happened in a gene. And that gave some organism arising therefrom an advantage in living in this planet over some other organism that it was related to. Now, this is Neo-Darwinism. Now, there are also a couple of other theories about evolution. One is called the saltation theory or the hopeful monster theory. Now, this is a reaction to the fact that there are too many gaps in the fossil record. Don't ever let any evolutionist tell you that the fossil record has proven evolution. We'll say more about that directly. It hasn't. Because there are so many problems with the fossil record, a fellow by the name of, two fellows by the name of Richard Goldschmidt and Otto Schwindewolf attempted to explain the absence of transitional forms in the fossil record by saying what happened was, and this is an oversimplification, but in the interest of time, we'll make it. One time a reptile laid an egg, and it hatched a bird. That's why it's also called the hopeful monster theory. Well, most evolutionists agree that it was Goldschmidt and Schwindewolf that laid the egg, and most of them refused to believe it. Another form of evolution that is actually gaining in popularity, as far as I can tell today, is punctuated equilibrium. Now, what this is, I don't know if I can grab a spell up there so you can read it, but punctuated equilibrium is simply a variation on Neo-Darwinism. The founders of this particular form of evolution say that these are the methods by which new species arise. But the way it actually happens, and by the way, this theory too was raised in response to the fact that there is no adequate evidence in the fossil record. There are the absence of transitional forms in the fossil record. This position says, and here we have a population, and this is population A. And then some natural barrier causes some small part of this population to be cut off from the rest. Over time, as natural selection and beneficial mutation do their work, this population begins to change. Slight changes at first. Eventually, it becomes a whole different species, species B. And eventually, the natural barrier is removed, and B mixes with A. And lo and behold, along come humans after a while, and they notice there's these two different species, but yet they can, in their so-called wisdom, see that they were one time related. Well, there are a number of objections to this, and all of these, of course, will be, all of these that pertain to Neo-Darwinism can be made against the other two, and I simply mention all this to show you that evolutionists are not even united in their beliefs. And so when they teach our children, when they teach us through some of their programs and so forth, that evolution is a proven fact, well then you might say, which camp of the evolutionists are holding on to the proven facts? And this is something that we need to point out to our children. Now I want to turn our attention to some of the fruits of Darwinian evolution. There are many things that could be mentioned. I believe that while Darwinism is itself a product of early rationalism and naturalistic philosophy, it has promoted a great deal of evil in our day and time. It has promoted materialism, humanism, which is I would call it a secular religion, which has exalted man to the position of God. Hedonism, or the attitude let the good times roll, is aided and abetted by evolution, because evolution just really writes God out of the picture. There's no judge or moral governor of our universe. So let the good times roll. There's no resurrection. Oh, we're just animals, glorified animals. That's what evolution says to our young, many people today. And so let the good times roll. I think some of the most pernicious influences of Darwinian evolution are to be found in the realm of social Darwinism. It has justified racism. It has justified war. It has justified a number of things that are absolutely immoral. The German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who held Christianity in contempt, said, a good cause, he said, you say a good cause sanctifies war, but I say a good war sanctifies every cause. He likewise ridiculed democracy and socialism for protecting the worthless and weak and hindering the strong. Social Darwinism and the anti-democratic cult of naked power, as preached by the advocates of Nietzsche, like Adolf Hitler, were laying the foundations of fascism, which would one day plunge the world into the most terrible convulsion in its history. It is interesting to study in the lives of men like Joseph Stalin, Karl Marx, Adolf Hitler, and Benito Mussolini, the influence of Charles Darwin. All of these men believed in struggle for existence. Karl Marx wrote to Charles Darwin and asked if it would be okay if he inscribed or dedicated his book, Das Kapital, Charles Darwin. Darwin refused the honor because he was married to a woman who was, interestingly enough, very religious. And apparently all his children were raised in the Church of England. And they were all taught that their father was as wrong could be about evolution. They all grew up and became evolutionists, though. So, this is something for us to ponder. Today, Charles Darwin is considered a hero of the Russian Revolution, because he adopted an atheistic position. At the same time, one of his close companions and cohorts, a fellow by the name of Thomas Huxley, is not considered a hero of the Russian or Soviet Revolution, because Huxley's position was agnostic. Huxley was always very careful to say to people, I don't know if God exists or not, and I don't believe you can prove he exists or not. That was Huxley's position. Well, the communists and the Soviets today, they just come out and say, we know God doesn't exist. We're atheists. That was the position Darwin adopted. So he is a hero of the Russian Revolution. He is the one, according to Karl Marx, who gave justification or gave a reason for not believing in God. In the Darwin Centennial in 1959, the USSR issued a coin and a stamp bearing Darwin's likeness. And as we've already said, He influenced men like Joseph Stalin, Frederick Engels, Karl Marx, Adolf Hitler, Benito Mussolini, and others. Now, I'd like to say something about science and the scientific method. We are living in a nuclear age when science is both feared and trusted. The typical person sees the marvels of modern scientific technology, and he can hardly keep from developing a faith in the theories and the facts of science. The remarkable accomplishments of science have tended to lend credibility to even the most tenuous theories taught in its name. The outgrowth of this has been an impression on many impressionable minds that science has dispensed with the necessity of a creator, that science has all the answers, and that intelligence is on the side of atheism and agnosticism. Now, we must make a point right here between what is pure science and what is practical science, between the theory and the technology. You know, today we carry around these cassette recorders, and we've got handheld calculators, and we've got 101 technological marvels that improve our lives. And this sort of builds in people a faith in science. We must realize, though, that the theories of science are not necessarily the working stuff of science, because it is the facts of science, facts about electricity, about solid-state electronics, and so forth, things that are demonstrable, things that are observable, provable in an objective sense. It is these things out of which technology arises. Now, the theories, sometimes they're a little more than guesses. And I want to make this point right here. You can go to school and you can become a doctor, and you'll be a good doctor. You can be a good doctor and not believe for 1 minute in evolution. And yet the evolutionists often portray that a person cannot be a scientist, cannot even be knowledgeable in this world unless they embrace evolution. But I know scientists who are not evolutionists. I had a teacher in school who was a creationist. He was a member of a denomination called the German Baptist Church. He was a scientist with Shell Labs for many years before he got his teaching certificate and began to teach. Perfectly capable as an entomologist. There are lots of people today who are scientists and very good in their chosen fields, be it chemistry, petrochemical engineering, or 101 other scientific disciplines or things like that. Maybe even teachers, and they don't believe in evolution. You see, you don't have to believe in evolution to be a good scientist or a good doctor or a good anything. You see, evolution is not really science. Evolution is a philosophy. And by its very nature, philosophy cannot be objectively demonstrated and proven. It is something that you believe in, you have faith in. Now, let me talk for a minute about how we understand and how we gain knowledge and how we come to accept things as facts. There's three ways you and I learn. Number one, we learn by instruction. Number two, we learn by observation. Number three, we learn by experience. And see, I told my little girl, Natalie. Now, Natalie, don't get near the oven, you might burn yourself. And so brother hears her, brother is sitting nearby and sees her touch the oven in disobedience to my instruction. Brother observes the pain and the agony that ensues. And of course, Natalie has learned by experience not to touch the oven. Well, this is how we gain knowledge. And in the scientific method, and this is really a simplification of a very deep subject, scientific method is basically taking observation and experience, making educated guesses out of that, and that is in turn taught to successive generations as that information, or as that information is assimilated, as it is embodied in hypotheses and theories, and as those theories are proven by continual evidence, by continual observation and experiment, that then passes into what may be called scientific law. And that, of course, is passed on to future generations through instruction. But here's the problem with evolution. Science is concerned with the observable and the experimentally verifiable. Evolution, and for that matter, creation, are not experimentally observable or verifiable. So they must be received on faith. Through what avenue? Can we observe creation? Or can we observe evolution? Can we observe or experience them? There's no way on earth that we can experience either one. There's only one way that we're going to find out anything about the origin of this world, and that is by instruction. And that's why I believe one of the The keys to an adequate defense against evolution is to instill in people a thoroughgoing confidence in the Bible. And it comes later in the lesson, which I'm not going to get to, so I'll say it right here. One of the best defenses is a good offense. You become thoroughly acquainted in the field of Christian apologetics and Christian evidences. You become acquainted with the arguments for the existence of God, with the fulfilled prophecies of the Scripture, with the scientific accuracy of the Scripture. You become thoroughly acquainted with the field of Christian evidences. And there are some very good books on this subject that are available. And that is one of the best defenses against evolution. Instill in people a confidence for God's revelation, which we believe, and I believe, is the only authentic instruction or revelation about how this world got here that man can have confidence in. Now, I want to turn our attention very hurriedly to the two basic mechanisms of evolution. Number one is natural selection. Number two is beneficial mutation. And I want to say something about them. Now, there are lots of problems with natural selection. And the evolutionary scientists generally accept this fact, that there are problems. There are just numerous exceptions that seem to disprove the theory of natural selection. Even before the basic principles of genetics were understood, it was natural for farmers to select types of animals and plants which pleased them most and use them to propagate the next generation. This is called breeding. By doing this, stocks were improved in the sense that herds and crops became more like the type which the farmers preferred. Now, the early evolutionists and early men didn't understand how this was being accomplished. We know today that there are genes and chromosomes that affect the heredity of future generations. And the desirable genes and chromosomes can be selected out of a stock of livestock or a group of livestock by simply choosing the ones that are more appealing, that have perhaps better muscle tone and so forth, and breeding them with others that are of similar type. And so eventually, you create a line or strain that has the most desirable genes and chromosomes. But in all of this, you have simply taken what was available in the gene pool, and you have sifted out what you didn't want, and you've kept what you wanted. But you haven't changed the genes, and you haven't changed the chromosomes. They're all still there, just like they were in the beginning, just like they were 1,000 years ago, or 8,000 years ago, or however long ago it was that God created this world. Charles Darwin proposed that a similar selection was going on in nature, only it was all proceeding by chance and accident in nature. Nobody was guiding it. Well, one of the prime difficulties of this theory of natural selection is the fact that many characteristics would in fact be liabilities instead of assets while still in an uncompleted state of development. Now, natural selection says that things proceeded very slowly. It's a very gradual process. But let's say here is a small furry mammal that is one day going to evolve into a bat. It's got some stubby little things sticking out the side of it that are going to be wings someday. And it decides to climb up this tree and try to sail off the tree. And so it climbs up the tree, it gets up there, and somehow falls off the tree, and he's going to die, isn't he? His little stubby wings aren't going to do him any good because they're not fully developed. Now, this is one of the problems, the problem with natural selection that prompted the saltation theory or the hopeful monster theory. The fact that all of a sudden, bingo, there was a bat born, you know. It had, you know, some kind of rodent had been its parents, but all of a sudden the rat was born, or the bat was born, and so forth. And then a really excellent example of the problem of natural selection is found in the case of the bombardier beetle, an interesting beetle that uses chemistry to foil its predators. The bombardier beetle has two glands, each with an outer and an inner compartment. In the inner compartment are stored two chemicals, hydroquinone and hydrogen peroxide, and he uses these by combining them in the outer chambers and spraying them at an enemy. There is an audible pop as an explosion takes place when these two chemicals are combined. When a beetle eater sneaks up on the bombardier beetle, the hydroquinone and the hydrogen peroxide are injected into a sort of reaction chamber, the outer chambers. Something is added in the way of an enzyme that causes an explosion to take place in the reaction chamber, that propels the hot toxic mixture into the face of the potential beetle eater. The question is, how did this beetle come by all of this complex and very interesting chemistry? How many bombardier beetles blew themselves to pieces experimenting and learning how to make the right combination of chemicals and the right enzymes to produce this very curious defensive arrangement? There are a number of other things that I might mention in the way of problems of natural selection. One of these that was pointed out by an evolutionist named Alfred Wallace was that human intelligence cannot be accounted for on the basis of natural selection. Alfred Wallace was a friend of Darwin, and in fact is considered by many to be a co-founder of the evolutionary theory. He spent some time living in the jungles of South America. It was his observation that these Indians were every bit as intelligent as Western men, although there was no reason for them to be that intelligent. According to his evolutionary theory, then it should have been Western men who were more highly intelligent simply because Western men had climbed further up the evolutionary ladder. That was the view, at least. But the Indians, he said, you could take one Indian out of this jungle and take him to England, teach him, and he'd be just as bright as anybody in England. And that was proven because there were North American Indians taken to England and to France in the early days of colonization and were educated and become fine, outstanding members of society. Maybe 20 years earlier, they'd been headhunters. It just proves that human intelligence is pretty much within certain parameters all around the world. It's all pretty good. And the only reason the Indians didn't have more knowledge is because more knowledge wasn't required. They had circumstances that they were able to feed themselves in and live in, and there was no desire to improve. So Wallace disagreed with Darwin. He thought that human intelligence was some kind of evidence against evolution. Now, he struggled with this problem, but he never resolved it because he remained an evolutionist. One of the early writers against evolutionary theory was William Paley. He died before Charles Darwin was born. And Charles Darwin would have had a formidable foe if Paley had still been alive. Now, Paley wrote a book titled Evidences, I believe, I don't remember the exact title of the book. I got it here in my notes someplace, but it was basically about the evidences for the Christian faith. And he made an argument from teleology, or that is, an argument from design, that there had to be a creator. And the gist of his, one of the main points of his argument is that the human eye is an absolute and complete refutation of the possibility of evolution. He compared the human eye to a telescope, and he basically said, we would be ridiculous to say that a telescope was in existence because of chance and happenstance. And why should we think that an eye, with all of its complexity, with all of its marvel, should be considered the result of evolutionary chance and accident? William Paley was perhaps the strongest proponent and presented most strongly a teleological argument.